Morning, everybody. I'm Rob Atkinson, president of ITIF, and a couple things. One is welcome to our new digs. Those of you who've been to our old place, we moved 3 weeks ago, and as you can tell, we're still working out the kinks. So this is actually supposed to work, but it doesn't. And so we're using a different one. And so again, welcome. I think it's a very interesting event today on health IT and privacy, and hear from a couple of leading academics who've done a very interesting study on this, and then a response and a debate. So to sort of moderate that, I'm going to turn over to Daniel Castro in a second. But also to just let you know, you probably haven't gotten the invitation, or if you haven't, we're doing an event on Wednesday morning here. We're doing professor events these days, I guess. We have two professors from Duke Law School who have a very compelling and interesting proposal on creating a White House Office of Innovation Policy as part of OMB. So we'll have a presentation Wednesday morning at 9 to talk about that, which is also on our website. So with that, Daniel.
Thanks, Rob. I guess we get all the professors during the summer because now they have time to come to Washington, D.C. If you're not familiar with some of our work, we've been involved in health policy for a while, health IT policy. We put out a report recently, Digital Quality of Life, that looks at the benefits of health IT. We go through some of the kind of benefits that most people talk about, the economic benefits, the cost savings, the improvements to quality of care. We also talk about improvements to medical research, which other people aren't always talking about. That report's in the back. We also have another report, Improving Healthcare, that we put out about 2 years ago, and it looks at policies to advance health IT in the United States, and we especially look at the health record data bank model. So again, if you haven't seen that report, I encourage you to look at that. And as one last final plug, we do have another report coming out this summer, that looks at international health IT leadership. So we look to see what countries are in the lead in health IT, what policies they've used to get there, and we definitely look at policies and concerns that we have in the United States, such as privacy and what other countries are doing to address those issues. I think when it comes to privacy, and you look at paper records that we have now and electronic health records, when you put them in a head-to-head matchup, electronic records always come out ahead. And that's because you can use technology like encryption, you can use automated audit logs to ensure that privacy is protected and that you know if somebody's accessed your data. You don't get that with paper-based records. But the purpose of the event today is to discuss this great article that came out recently, Privacy Protection and Technology Diffusion, the Case of Electronic Medical Records. It was in, I think, the May 2009 issue of Management Science, and it looks at the effect of state privacy regulations on EMR adoption. I think this is very timely because obviously right now we're in the midst of a debate about health IT and what policies we need to get universal adoption, and we're also talking about ways to reduce the cost of healthcare. So we need to understand the impact of privacy regulations. And I think, you know, if we think about privacy regulations in the past in healthcare, I know I remember HIPAA regulations. When those first came out and the HIPAA privacy rules first came out, people wondered, or doctors were very concerned about whether or not this would affect their ability to even consult with their patients by email. And this kind of ambiguity can slow innovation, can slow the diffusion of certain technology. And I guess all of this is really part of a broader debate that you see often with technology and privacy. And on the one hand, you have people who say privacy regulations can actually speed adoption because it boosts consumer confidence. And then on the other hand, you have people saying that privacy regulations slow adoption because they present barriers to business. And there's probably some truth to both sides. And I'm not sure we're going to get a definitive answer today, but we're certainly going to learn more about what the evidence says. So we have a great panel today. First, we have Amalia Miller with the Department of Economics at the University of Virginia, and Catherine Tucker with the MIT Sloan School of Management. They're the co-authors of the report, and they'll be presenting on that report today. And then we'll hear a response from Devin McGraw with the Center for Democracy and Technology. Most of you know Devin is the director of the Health Privacy Project at CDT. And she'll be doing about a 10 to 15 minute response to the presentation, and then we'll go to both sides, about 5 minutes to respond to anything that was said in the presentation, accusations, criticisms. And then we'll have Q&A open to the audience. We'll be ending at 3:30. So.
Okay, well, thank you very much, Devin. Thank you for giving us this opportunity to come and speak to a group of people who are actually, you know, very invested in answering this question about privacy and electronic medical records. So, my job today is to really describe to you paper that we wrote, what we found and what the data said. And then I think what we really are excited about in terms of this forum is a chance to discuss, well, what should we take from the data? What interpretations should we place on what we find? And how should this actually affect policy going forward? But as I say, I'm going to try and stick narrowly to what the paper says and the data. So we're studying electronic medical records, and these are, in a very narrow sense, the set of technologies which allow healthcare providers to record and exchange information using electronic means rather than paper records. Now, there's something about a medical record which really engenders fears about privacy. You know, I don't really want the news that I have an enlarged prostate broadcast around the world, and it's these kind of feelings which have led 50% of states in the period that we study to have enacted state-level privacy protection, which is going to restrict the release of electronic health information. And in this paper, we ask a simple question, which is, how does this state-level privacy regulation affect the adoption of EMR? And we're both, I think, by nature and training, statisticians. And we had no real views about what we were going to find when we started this project, because there were two competing camps about what the implication of the state privacy regulation might be. On the one hand, there's a camp that says, well, having this privacy protection in place is a good thing, as Dan said, because it actually encourages patients to have confidence in the system. And if doctors know that patients have confidence, then they're going to be more likely to push for the adoption of such technologies. On the other hand, there's a camp that says, well, having these kind of regulations in place impose costs, mandate costly customization, which makes it more unlikely that hospitals and other healthcare providers are going to adopt such systems. And so it seemed to us very much an empirical question about whether or not these state privacy regulations helped or hindered the adoption of EMR. Now, this is no murder mystery novel, so I'm going to give you away the result on the second page, which is what we found when we looked at the data was actually that states which had these privacy laws in them, hospitals tended to have a 21 to 24% lower rate of adoption compared to comparable hospitals, that is, hospitals with similar characteristics, in states which did not have these privacy laws. And we're going to present evidence today that this suppression adoption came through a suppression of network externalities. Now, I realize that's a bit of economic jargon, and by that I mean that the ability of hospitals to exploit the interactive benefits of this technology was suppressed. Now, why does this matter? Well, we'll talk about this a lot more later. But basically, we're facing this challenge that in this recent stimulus bill, $20 billion approximately, has been devoted to push the adoption of healthcare IT. And it's important to think about, well, if it is the case, there are these trade-offs between privacy regulation and speedy adoption of electronic medical records. Where does that get us? Now, let me go into detail about the study. So we're going to be looking at hospital adoption of EMR. Obviously, there are many other different healthcare providers who could adopt EMR, but we're going to be just looking at hospitals. Electronic medical records, it's a costly technology. If you're very lucky, you could buy a Bayer Boon system for $100,000, but realistically, as a hospital, you're going to be spending millions. So it's a decision which is going to be taken very seriously with a lot of deliberation. Now, an electronic medical record system has both standalone and network benefits. Now, let me explain what I mean by that. A standalone benefit is something that a hospital enjoys from adopting an electronic medical record system, even if no other hospitals adopt. And we can imagine these to include, it's just very nice to be able to get rid of paper, it streamlines efficiency within the hospitals, it means that doctors within a hospital treating the same patient have a lot easier access to the same information. So a lot of standalone benefits just the hospital, even if other hospitals don't adopt. However, we also might think there are actually network benefits from adopting this technology for hospital, and these are going to be contingent on other hospitals also adopting. And so if I'm a doctor at one hospital, for example, it's going to be useful for me when I see a patient come into an emergency room. If I can pull out records for that patient from another hospital, identify whether or not they're anemic, and if it was the case that they had a chronic disease, that I could track, say, the process of the growth of a tumor over time. And these network benefits are going to be contingent on being able to exchange information for another hospital. So, as I said, these states have adopted privacy regulations. And given this setup of these potential benefits of EMR, we can imagine that actually these privacy regulations could encourage the adoption of EMR by hospitals if patients felt more easy to share information when talking to their doctors. There is some survey evidence out there which suggests that if it's an embarrassing condition, patients are more likely to not see their own doctor. They're more likely to try and pay out of pocket so it doesn't appear anywhere on an electronic record. And it's this kind of privacy-protecting of behavior which might make the medical record less valuable for the doctor. And so therefore, we might think that privacy protection is actually improving the value of an electronic medical record. Now, on the other hand, if we have privacy protection in place, and in particular the kind of privacy protection which is going to dull the ability of hospitals to actually exchange information about patients, then this may reduce the network benefits that a hospital receives, and therefore privacy regulation could inhibit hospitals from adopting. Now, so this is a setup, and we went out to actually obtain data about to study this question. And there were two kinds of data we were using. The first is data actually on what state health privacy protection exists. And we were very fortunate in this, in that there's been this health privacy project at Georgetown, which has tracked very closely the evolution of state privacies over time. And they've, in particular, they had reports out in 2002, 1999, and 1996. And we're going to use these to actually study how, when a state changes its privacy regime, this actually affects how hospitals respond in terms of their adoption. Now, I want to be upfront and say there's actually quite a wide variety in terms of what the content of these laws are. We're not going to be looking at that. We're just going to be looking at whether or not there was a privacy law in place. And so in the paper, for example, we have the text in the Florida privacy law. And you see there that it's actually relatively strict in terms of requiring patient authorization for a sharing of health information between different hospitals, at least the broadest interpretation. On the other hand, Massachusetts law is a lot more specific, and it tends to focus in on the release of information which might give a hint to someone's psychiatric, their drug or alcohol use, or their HIV status, the kind of information that these folks in Massachusetts are very concerned about employers and insurance agencies getting their hands on. Now, we have this data about health privacy protection, which we're going to reduce to whether or not the state has a law and how it's changed over time. And then we also have very detailed data on a panel of hospitals in each of the states and how their adoption changed over time in the period we study. Okay. So I'm going to show you two tables of numbers today. These are two sets of results. The first set of results is really going to compare correlations in adoptions in states that have privacy laws and that don't. And then I'm going to present you some final figures which suggest, well, what is the actual aggregate effect of these laws? Now, I put up an equation. Don't let all these subscripts and so on worry you. All this is basically saying is that we're going to model adoption in the following way. We're going to see whether or not a hospital is going to adopt, and we're going to let this vary by whether or not hospitals in the local health service area have also adopted, and we're going to let it also vary on the hospital's characteristics, whether it's a big hospital, small hospital, and we're also going to put in time trends for the state and for the hospital, and also over time. Just to give you a bit more detail, because I think this is probably more useful than actually looking at an equation, just to visualize what we're doing in a sort of empirical manner, is that The dependent variable, that is what we're going to be trying to explain with our model all the time, is whether or not a hospital adopts. And we're going to be seeing how this is varying with other hospital adoption decisions given the privacy regime. And we're also going to be controlling for a lot of things about each of the hospitals and how they change over time. And so we can see here the kind of information we're going to have about the hospital. We're going to have information about its organizational structure, its payroll, its number of beds, a lot of detail about things which might influence a hospital. Now, adoption decision. Now, why do we do this? It's because we want to compare similar hospitals, similar characteristics, similar sizes, in states that have privacy regimes and those that don't, in order that we actually have a fair comparison. And we want to see the incremental difference, controlling for everything else, that having a privacy regime in place makes. So let me get you to some numbers straight away. So these are incredibly simplified forms of the tables, which I think take out pages in the paper. But there are just really two numbers to take away from them. So the first number is the 0.021. What does this mean? It means that in states which have no privacy laws, you see that if a hospital adopts, it tends to be correlated with the adoption of other hospitals by 0.21. Or in other words, if one hospital adopts in a three-year period, this actually has a 2% positive impact on the likelihood of neighboring hospitals adopting. So we see this positive kind of a network effect or correlation and conglomeration in terms of hospitals adopting in states which have no privacy law. And we interpret this as suggesting these hospitals are adopting together because they expect to be able to usefully exchange health information. However, in states which have privacy laws in place, that is, these kind of laws which actually make it more difficult to exchange information, we actually see no such evidence of such positive effects in terms of the influence of one hospital adopting on another. So what does this mean? Well, it means that in terms of, because we get this positive boost from one hospital adopting in states which don't have privacy law, that if given that there tend to be about three or four neighboring hospitals in the health regions we're looking at, that we would be estimating around over the period we study a 21% positive boost just from this agglomeration effect, that hospitals tend to be encouraged adoption by each other, and we don't see such an effect with states which have privacy laws.
Okay, question.
Of course.
Is that 0.21 per year?
It's 2.2. It's 0.021 per three-year period. And we also present evidence in the paper which sort of has a cross-section on aggregate for our 10-year period we study, and that comes out as about 0.07 or 7% boost from a hospital adopting over a 10-year period. Now,
so it's 7% more likely.
It's set if you're
within those 10 years, it's 7% more likely that they'll.
If my neighboring hospital adopts, that boosts my probability of adoption by 7%. And there tend to be about three hospitals in my local area who adopt, so we can think of a boost of about 21%. That's where that figure comes from. Now, we did a lot of checking of the results of these results, because they were quite striking. I think I won't focus on this now, because I don't know how many people are interested in the technical details, but I'd be very happy to talk about them later on. But suffice to say, we did all the usual statistical tests, and then we also made sure that we couldn't find the same results if we looked at a different kind of technology where we wouldn't expect these kind of network benefits. Now, as I said, we had these back-of-the-envelope calculations from these statistics, which suggested that adoption was boosted by about 21% for this installed base effect in states which didn't have the privacy law. However, in some ways, it's also interesting to just estimate independently the actual effect of an aggregate effect of the privacy law rather than just looking at these installed base effects. And so we went on to do this, and we ran another regression, and this is simply looking at hospitals and their adoption decisions in states which have privacy laws. And remember that these privacy laws are changing over time in the data that we're looking at, and so we're seeing how these changes affect behavior. And we see that in a three-year period, that this decreases the rate of adoption if there's a privacy law in place by around 11%, or 0.11 in the table. And we also did another thing which estimated the aggregate effect over 10 years, and we got an estimate which suggested that there was a decrease in adoption of around 24% overall for the states which had these privacy protections in place over the 10-year period. Now, there is some support for these results in terms of industry anecdote, though I think that they've probably been less highlighted in recent years. And I've got a quote here from Alan Mertz, who mentions that this patchwork of privacy laws at the state level is an impediment to the exchange of health information. And we also, you know, there's some anecdotal evidence too. If you look at something like the collapse of the Santa Barbara Regional Health Information Organization, where partly the collapse can be explained, or at least they explained it, in terms of how costly it was to maintain the state privacy filters that were mandated by California in terms of exchanging information. Before I conclude, I just want to mention another paper we've written. And this is actually trying to measure the positive effects of EMR. Because at the moment, if you look at the sort of research that's been done, there's a lot of people saying that this is one of the greatest things ever and could revolutionize American healthcare. However, there's little that people haven't been able to find that much in the data so far. However, we actually did a very broad study which looked at how the adoption of this kind of technology and also radiology information systems affected infant mortality. And this is attractive because this is something we have a lot of data about. It's also something we're worried about in the US in terms of how poorly the US lags behind its neighbors in terms of infant mortality. And we found evidence that, yes, healthcare IT can actually save the lives of babies, and we suggest that it could result between 5 and 19 deaths for 100,000 lives births. And there was also, you know, in terms of the cost effectiveness, this actually seemed relatively cost effective compared to other technologies often studied, and that in terms of how much it costs per infant that you save, you'd be spending around $450,000 in terms of investments in these kind of electronic medical records technologies. So I think there's no doubt when you're trying to crystallize these results about privacy protection that electronic medical records are indeed something that we want to be encouraging. You know, but what this study is trying to do is actually document, well, there are certainly benefits in terms of health of speeding up the diffusion of electronic medical records, and we have documented it in terms of the saving of babies' lives at least. However, when we want privacy protection in place, there are actually difficult trade-offs in place. That is, that if we put up, if, you know, at the state level, at least when they input, when you see stringent privacy regulation being implemented, there seems to be the case that hospitals are less likely to adopt in those states compared to other hospitals in that might look similar but happen to be in states which don't have privacy protection. So it's not the case, and I want to clarify this, that we're saying that privacy protection is at all a bad thing. That's not the case at all. What we are saying, however, is that there are trade-offs between having privacy protection in place, it appears, and actually speeding up the adoption of electronic medical records. So with that, I'd like to say thank you and hand over to the speaker.
I want to thank you both. I've been through this paper a couple of times now, and I get a little more out of it each time, having just taken two economics classes many, many years ago. And statistics, yeah, I tried to avoid that. So, well done, and I appreciate it. I also want to start off by apologizing. I am not the privacy beatnik who wears flip-flops, but I broke my toe, and now my foot doesn't fit into any of my shoes. It's not an indication of that I'm taking this not seriously. I actually am. So I want to start off by saying that I'm not going to criticize the study, because number one, I don't feel like I'm really qualified to do so, and I don't think it's preposterous at all. I think they're raising important points that we need to think about. There is value that we want to gain from moving to electronic medical records, and all of these questions should be fair game and should be on the table for further discussion. I think the question that I continue to have in my mind when I look through this study is, so what is this telling us from a policy standpoint? What are the take-home lessons from this? Because to me, it raises sort of an initial set of questions, maybe a little bit of a yellow flag, but not a red flag in my view, because, I don't think we're talking about a dichotomy of, well, we either do privacy or we don't. Because that's, I think that's not what we're talking about, and I actually don't think that's what the authors are trying to tell us. I mean, I'll concede that the absence of any laws whatsoever regulating the flow of health data would certainly create a more free and permissive environment for information sharing. But I think that there are some consequences to that which would need to be weighed. The paper has a pretty good section about what, it's not quantitative data on people's privacy concerns, it's qualitative data about how people feel about having their health information moved in a digital form, either online, via the web, via a set of network servers, whatever kind of models are being explored out there. People are really concerned, and they've even got the study in there about what we call privacy protective behaviors. We're in a paper-based world. People were already talking about doing things like lying to their doctors and going to different doctors so that their records were more dispersed and couldn't be easily linked to them. Of course, if we create this network, that's not really going to work very well for folks anymore. But nevertheless, I mean, there are some serious concerns out there, and it's not just about losing health insurance coverage, although that's a big one, and if we were able to address that as part of healthcare reform, I think we'd be well on our way to alleviating what are some of people's really large concerns about this. But it's also things like, when can employers get my data, which is, we haven't really address that in a really comprehensive way, and it would be a difficult one to address politically, at least at the federal level. And marketing, even some of these state laws that have some restrictions on how data can be shared, and they're typically dealing with certain types of sensitive health data, the protections vis-a-vis marketing are actually fairly weak. We tried to do some work on that at the federal level, but I think we haven't gone through the implementation of that yet and don't really know how successful we were at creating greater obstacles to the use of people's information for marketing without their authorization. And the statistics about concerns on privacy are actually more alarming when you talk to people who are in racial and ethnic minority groups, and given that part of what we're trying to do here is reduce disparities in healthcare, if all we do is exacerbate that situation, that's not helpful. So in my view, the questions that I really want to have answered are probably, and hopefully, phase two of somebody's study on this, and it would be great if you guys took up the mantle. Again, because I don't think it's privacy or no privacy, it's, are there particular types of state laws that create greater burdens on the sharing of information, and what do those laws look like? What is it in particular that creates this obstacle, and can we do this in a better way? The laws where the benefits to privacy are arguably negligible, and yet the burdens for industry are quite high with respect to cost and the ease of implementation. I know a lot of recent state statutes that have come out have been very focused on giving patients a stronger consent role with respect to exchange of their data. And that's normally, again, with respect to particular types of sensitive health information, but it's not necessarily limited to that. And we've done some papers before on the appropriate role of consent in healthcare, where I think we make a reasonably good case. People could, of course, argue that consent does very little in the way of protecting patient privacy, because it puts all of the burden for protecting your privacy on you and your ability to read and understand a consent form, which is telling you how your data is going to be shared. And yet it has this consequence on the part of providers where they're very nervous about sharing data for fear that they don't have the proper authorizations and consents in place. And so I think, thinking about those and as sort of more deep exploration is is definitely in order. I also want to posit that sometimes it's not the laws, but the way they're being interpreted in very divergent ways. This was actually a point that was kind of buried in the recent IOM research report, but I think it's very instructive. You know, institutions have to, with their own degree of how much risk they want to tolerate, interpret what a particular statute means with respect to how they can share data. And I have seen time and time again what I will call over-interpretation of what the law requires in an effort to sort of be covered from a legal standpoint for how they share data. And this becomes particularly problematic when we start ratcheting up the penalties for failing to comply, which is a very appealing thing from a privacy advocate standpoint. You don't want a rule without a remedy, a right without a remedy, or rules that aren't enforced are more likely to be ignored. But at the same time, if you go from, you know, a slow burn to you're, you know, boiling the bunny, it's, you know, people are going to react and be more cautious about how they share data, which is going to have an impact on the types of benefits that we can get from legislation like this. So how do we fix that? I mean, we had, you know, really only one administration has administered, at least at the federal level, the HIPAA privacy rule. And while I've criticized them frequently for very lax enforcement, my other criticism is that they hardly ever issued any guidance on how the rule ought to be interpreted. Once it was sort of put out there, it was like, well, you guys are on your own with respect to what this really means. And there were lots of misconceptions about what HIPAA said and didn't. And when I say HIPAA, you know, I'm referring to a federal law and not state laws, but you can imagine that this then gets magnified at the state level. And, you know, while I was definitely in favor of the privacy rule provisions that we got in the economic stimulus legislation, I will say that there, you know, was more than one occasion where I was concerned about, you know, maybe the way that they were written, how are we going to implement this? And we're at this stage now where we're trying to implement them. And I think, you know, that there are enormous challenges. And in the meantime, while we try to figure all of this out, we have, once again, an uncertain environment in which people will act more cautiously than not. And you can't really blame them for doing that. So I'm really hoping that we can get sort of more information about the types of laws that create the obstacles. And then out of this new administration, which doesn't even feel so new anymore, it feels like they've been around for forever, so much has happened, you know, a kind of a more rigorous attention paid to getting out good information to both patients and providers. Here's what the law says, here's what it requires. You know, and let's do our best in this implementation phase with these new laws. I'll just say a couple of things. The inconsistent state law point, the one thing that I was curious about is you guys looked at state laws, not how the patchwork affects national information exchange. So I'm not sure what your study tells us about the fact that there are different state laws in these states, and maybe that's an area for further study, or we can all sit down and read the voluminous health information security and privacy collaborative reports that have been issued over time, because their whole purpose was to look at not going to one standard, but how do you harmonize what are some very different and sometimes inconsistent legal regimes when we're trying to actually create a national, ultimately national health exchange. And then now we actually do have some significant federal dollars on the table, which we didn't during the time that the two of you were collecting your data. And it makes me wonder. And, you know, the $20 billion figure was the one that I used for several months, and now it's been ratcheted up to 49 because the Medicare incentives are such a, and Medicaid incentives are such a big piece of it, and people are now revising their estimates about what the uptake rate is going to be. So, you know, as we're speaking, it's probably growing yet again or going down now that we're finding out what meaningful use might mean, and people are nervous that they're not going to be able to get this done. But at any rate, I wonder, so the last thing I'll say is I wonder what the impact is of finally actually putting, you know, real federal dollars on the table, and what that's going to mean in terms of this net, you know, the absence of the network effect from the privacy issue. Does that then get countered by this new set of incentives, or do we have to worry about people not taking advantage of them because of the very issues that you raise in your paper? And I'll stop there.
Great. Thank you, Devin, so much for your very thoughtful comments. So I'll be brief, but first of all, just in appreciation of Devin's comments, this is a very civil and constructive debate. And actually, I don't think we have as much to disagree about as maybe some people in the audience were hoping for. So there won't be any blood. But more or less, I just want to start by reiterating the main point of our study, and which I think that Devin has agreed with and repeated herself, but just to make this point, our study is showing evidence that these privacy protections, these particular state laws, have led to a slowing of the diffusion of electronic medical records. And the fact that we're finding this effect suggests a real cost associated with strong privacy protection for health information. The fact that there's a cost suggests that any discussion about the design of privacy protection should take a framework of thinking about trade-offs and thinking about costs versus benefits of particular regulations in terms of the extent and the nature of regulations. I think this is a point that is not always a point that's well made in the debate. It's not a point that's always well understood. But I think that this framework, thinking about trade-offs, thinking about costs and benefits, is very useful and very important to have in mind. And I'm glad that it's not a controversial point, at least among the panelists so far. So I just wanted to start by talking about that. And then, since I have an opportunity, I'm going to try to respond a little bit to Devin's very thoughtful and important questions about where do we go for the future. But I want to be perfectly clear. I'm going to highlight the ways in which our paper actually doesn't address a lot of these questions that Devin asks, and maybe think about some areas that we mutually agree would be beneficial for future study. So I think the question about where do we go from here, we acknowledge a cost. I think that's the first step, and I think that's important, acknowledging that there can be a cost, which means that we really want to think about, for future policy, identifying areas where we can potentially improve policy. And there are kind of two types of elements that have been identified. One is looking at within a state, what's the best way to design your privacy law? The other question is there something about a national coordination or harmonizing of privacy laws? In terms of thinking about the state laws, there is substantial variation, which Catherine mentioned and Devin mentioned also, in terms of the actual laws. And some, Florida is an example of a law that is very broadly defined. Now, although we supposed, and I think there's good reason to suppose, that having very broadly defined laws could increase the costs of privacy protection, in terms of our research, we haven't been able to statistically find an important effect. So although there is a lot of variation, and some states do have much more targeted laws, Massachusetts was a good example, we're not finding substantial differences in terms of this rate, in terms of this effect of slowing technology between states with broader laws and states with more narrowly defined laws. Now, part of that may come back to the point that Devin was making, which is that there seems to be a very conservative interpretation that's going on at the hospital level. They're very cautious about being sued. They have experience of being sued in areas unrelated to privacy. And so their legal teams, I think, may be advising them to be cautious on this. And so even if a law doesn't exactly pin down what's permissible, it seems that we might be seeing some caution. Now, in terms of what that means for future policy, our study cannot distinguish. Is it the privacy rule itself? Is there something we can tweak in the language that would make a difference? Or is it just the fact of having something on the books that's making a difference? Is it that the laws are not being interpreted well, and so maybe some kind of information campaign would make a difference? Or is it that there's nothing you can do without changing the laws? In our study, we're looking at actual events, actual laws, and actual decisions to adopt. We can only look at what the data there is, and it's not really informative on that point, although I think we agree, very important, interesting points for going forward. Again, in order to assess whether or not a patchwork is causing a problem, we would need another United States that didn't have a patchwork, and then compare. That experiment doesn't exist, so we can't answer that with our study, but we do think that that's an interesting and important area for future work. Now, there is, I think that's all I want to say in terms of in terms of this area, although I think Devin did make a point that I thought I'll just mention again, I thought was important. When we get into this framework about trade-offs and thinking about optimal design of the policy, I think a really fruitful direction to go is to think about areas where we have highest benefits from protecting privacy weighed against the smallest costs. And so one possibility would be to think about populations, specific populations where there is a real cost associated with having their health information not be as private, and to maybe target legislation. We don't have empirical evidence that that's going to eliminate this negative effect that we found, but it seems like a fruitful area for future study. The final point that I just wanted to mention, which I think is just relates back to our second paper, so this is a plug for more of our research, is that in our study looking at the benefits in terms of the benefits from healthcare IT in terms of improving health outcomes, I do just want to mention that one of the benefits we found was this overall effect of hospitals adopting of computerized records and computerized radiology systems saved babies. There was also a benefit in terms of reducing the racial disparity in health outcomes. And so we find a benefit, an overall benefit, and we find a benefit for African American babies that's twice as large as the average benefit. And so when we think about these policies, I think Devin kind of introduced this idea of thinking about disparities, thinking about who's being hurt and who's being helped, is also something that would be considered. So thank you again for everyone coming, and I'm looking forward to hearing Devin's response and then maybe exploring a little bit more on these broader issues during the Q&A.
I think the only thing that I'll add is I just don't like the word trade-off. No, you know, well, here's why. Just so that I like to think about, you know, the optimum set of privacy rules being set at a level that allows information to take sharing to take place in a pretty free way for making sure that people get the healthcare treatment, while, you know, putting some parameters around some of the secondary uses. And that's something, that's actually a point that we make in our consent paper. We actually say that HIPAA is the right approach, even if I might not agree with every single component of it, which is allow information to be shared for treatment payment and a core set of administrative tasks that are critical to making sure you get treated and your healthcare gets paid for, assuming that you have insurance. Historically, we in the privacy community don't like trade-off because that's usually the word that gets used when they're about to tell you that you have to give up something really important in order to get something else. I prefer to think of it as, let's structure the right set of privacy rules because consumers really want both. They want their information to be protected, but they also want their information to be available to their doctors. They want their information on their babies to be available. And so it's really becomes a, it's not a huge point. It's more of a semantic point, and I think ultimately the conclusion is still the same. When you think about creating a legal regime that governs information sharing, you have to have both sets of considerations in mind. So it's just the trade-off for it. I was like, no, I don't want a trade-off. I want to set the rule in the right place. But but it's the same thing. It's essentially the same thing. And I think that's the last thing I'll say. Thanks for the opportunity to comment. I want you guys to do some of these other studies that we talked about.
Well, thanks to all three of you, and we'll start with some questions in a minute. I do want to give you guys a chance to respond. It looked like you wanted to respond to that trade-off comment, so if we want to start there, you can go ahead, and if you want to respond just from your seat, especially Devin with your toe, I don't want to have that trade-off of louder sound and your pain.
The trade-off of microphone.
Yeah, I think at the end of the day, Devin doesn't want to use the word, but I think it's just the word.
Right.
It seems like we agree on the idea. So in designing the optimal,
right,
you're considering the trade-offs, but if you don't like the word, I may use it again today.
That's okay. That's okay.
But you don't have to.
Right. Thank you.
If you would just state your name and any organization you're with.
Arlene Coleman, Technology Policy Institute. Thank you for a really very interesting paper, which enjoyed. I was wondering whether you really had a chance, I asked the question for several reasons, have you had a chance to look directly at these hypothesized network externalities or actual exchanges of information? Because I might imagine, I know you control for a lot of variables, but there's still a possibility of omitted variable bias, I think, in your results. I'm sort of not sure it's all coming from, the results are coming from these externalities. Are these hospitals where other hospitals have adopted, or in those areas where there are no privacy rules, are they really exchanging information? Do you see that happening? And I'm, so I'm curious about that, both as a test of your results, and also because in the health IT world we're now in, where we're going to be looking at meaningful use, actual exchange of information is going to become important. So, another, and also I just kind of have a suspicion, or you may have looked at this already, the possibility that some of your health outcomes, the improved health outcomes and improved, you know, reduced racial disparities might be coming from greater capital intensity, which may not be fully captured in your control variables.
It's a two-part question. So the first part was asking about what do we know about actual use. So in this paper, we don't look at the actual exchange of information as an outcome. Rather, it's something that we sort of infer from the presence of this correlated adoption. And the fact that the correlated adoption goes away under the strict privacy regime provides some suggestive evidence that that's the channel for why we're seeing these spillovers rather than just peer effects or sort of imitation. Now, we do have some other research that's not in this paper where we've actually gotten some data from the first ever study by the American Hospital Association where they actually ask about hospitals exchanging information. And this is a national survey with all from the AHA, and there is a high level of exchange of information. We haven't analyzed all of that data yet in terms of pinning it down, linking it to the privacy laws, but that is some work that we're doing now on future study, looking at exactly which hospitals are sharing information, and in particular we're thinking about within systems versus cross systems. And there could be a very important role for the privacy regime for that as well. So for this study, we don't actually have information, and probably the way to think about the results that we're seeing with the correlated effects is it's more about the potential to exchange information. In the time period that we're looking at, actual information exchange was not that common. It's becoming more common. And so there were examples of some regional initiatives that were just starting, but it was more about the potential. And the way to think about what we find there is if you know that other hospitals have adopted, then you know that in the future you may be able to exchange with them, even if you're not exchanging right away. In terms of the second point, did you want to add to that?
No, that's great.
And let me just respond. On the second point, in terms of the baby's paper, I think that I'm going to encourage people to read the paper. There's a lot of details, but in terms of your concern about capital structure, that is something that we are able to control for in our data. We're able to control for the hospital we have information about the hospital, a lot of financial variables concerning their payments and their staff. We also have information about their investment in other technology. So in particular, neonatal intensive care units, that technology was also diffusing slightly earlier time period, and that's something that we've controlled for explicitly. And so that is not affecting the results. What we're seeing is benefits from radiology info systems and from EMR seems to be separate from other capital investments.
Go ahead.
Hi, Dan Gilman, FTC. Professor Melrose, I like this paper quite a bit and have wondered about some of the things that were brought up. I'm wondering if any of the things that have come out recently or that are coming out in terms of variation in state laws sort of might give you a tool ready at hand for looking at a more fine, you know, so in the first paper, there's this sort of binary choice with the HOSPRIVE law variable. They've got something above the federal floor on hospital information sharing, or they don't. Then you try to look at, you know, some general idea of breadth or specificity of the law. I know that Joy Pritzker, we're supposed to be coming out with a new paper on variation of states. I don't know whether this could give you some sort of matrix with which to just say, look, there are these nine categories, this one pops out. And also there's something the HISPC, one of the consortia it wasn't clear to me what the upshot of this was, but there was an interesting project one of the consortia had, one of the Interstate Consortia, where they sort of developed, had the software project for information sharing, where a hospital in State A interested in sharing information with a hospital, hospitals in States B and C could sort of run this thing, and it would pop up, right, for psychiatric information, yeah, and B, you need it, and C, you don't. You need some sort of consent. Now, what they're to do with that, they go to the general counsel's office, and they say, oh, we don't need it here, we do need it here, so what do we do? And the general counsel says, well, terrific, you've got, you know, these check marks, I don't know what we should do. I don't know how you proceed from that, but it may just be to the extent that the consortium was getting together and coming up with some sort of table of legal categories or consent categories. It may be that something just pops out that, you know, here's something in the can, we can just look for this wrinkle. I don't know if that's useful or not.
So to date, we have been a little bit limited by what data are available, and so the latest version of the Health Privacy Project study is 2002. Although, I think Devin can answer this a little bit better. So thank you for the suggestion about the consortium. We're going to look into that. We are definitely interested in looking at this variation. We haven't been able to pick anything up to it now.
Yeah, that report, it is really hard to do 50-state surveys, for anybody in the room who's ever done them before, and then to keep them up to date. So the last time, and this is the very same Health Privacy Project, actually. Joy is an alumnus? Of the project, and she's at the Georgetown Center for Medical Privacy Rights. The Health Privacy Project is actually the project that it gets subsumed into CDT, so a little bit of corporate maneuvering. But at any rate, we don't have the bandwidth to be continuously updating that, unfortunately. But Joy's study that you just referred to is a federally funded look across 50 states at a few sensitive health information domains. So it's not a 50-state survey. It's not going to tell people, here is the complete set of laws in the state of Alabama that you need to know. What it's going to do is look at what are the rules for mental health information across all 50 states and the District of Columbia on this point. So it is going to be helpful, but there are still going to be some unanswered questions, and I think you put your finger also on, well, what do you then do with that data once you have it? If it's a state that you're not familiar with, are you going to rely on, you know, some chart? And, mm-hmm. you know, having, I'm on a HIPAA lawyer's listserv, and people will periodically post questions, and there's at least 12 different responses to a question about what should we do in this particular case. And it's so the implementation challenges, even when you have the data, are just enormous. I don't know the best way to do that.
Go ahead.
David Bruggen, Association for Computing Machinery. Specifically wanted to poke a little bit at the notion of decreased network effects independent of the technology in which the records are kept. So in terms of the privacy restrictions, I'm not sure that states are necessarily going to target simply electronic health information. And so I was wondering to what extent, I mean, is there a significant difference between the decreased network effects for electronic health records versus other health records? And how would that factor into this study?
So I think the idea is that the privacy laws don't apply just to computerized records. They apply to paper records as well. I think the way that we've thought about this issue is, in some ways, the metaphor we had in mind was that when you're exchanging information by paper or by fax through the mail, there's a physical barrier that is making it difficult to exchange information. There's this challenge, it's costly to exchange information, to send information from hospital A to hospital B. Part of the benefit of having computerized records of healthcare IT is that you can reduce that physical barrier. It becomes costless or much less costly from a physical technological point of view to exchange health information. In some sense, what the privacy rules are doing is by putting a barrier to the exchange of health information, by adding a cost back in, They're differentially hurting electronic records. Even though that cost applies to paper records as well, paper records were costly to exchange in the first place. And so it's reducing that incremental advantage that you would have had, that benefit, that network benefit from easier information exchange that would have been a big advantage for IT. Now that's being, that barrier, that physical barrier is being lowered, and in place there's a legal barrier that's coming up.
I think another issue with error to control is that arguably stronger privacy protections would support more accurate patient information, mm-hmm. and so there's got to be some way to control for that.
We hope it does.
Well, consider the fact that patients may not opt to participate in systems that have electronic health records that aren't private.
Mm-hmm. Right, right.
So in one sense, the hospitals adopt, but if the patients don't, where are you?
I'd like to follow up on that, and Devin, get your opinion on this. I wasn't completely clear from what you said. Consent is obviously a big issue, especially for many privacy advocacy groups, and most argue for opt-in models. And I was going to mention that in the study we have coming out, one of the countries we looked at is the Netherlands, and the Netherlands patients have the option for opting in to electronic data exchange of their health information. It turns out that only about 2% opt out, so that when you have this kind of automatic opt-in, or when you have an opt-out situation, you don't have that many people opting out, especially when it works well and protects their privacy. I just wanted to get a little more from you on whether you thought an opt-out scenario was possible for Health IT, or whether that's something that they use for.
Well, I'm glad you asked that question, Daniel, because in our consent paper, we make a distinction between what the patient, what the role of consent should be with respect to internal use and one-to-one data sharing, absent a sort of organized formal health information sharing network like a what are called RIOs or health information exchanges or HIEs. And because those formalized structures are so new and are really something that patients don't necessarily expect will happen. They actually all think that all this data, not all, but many patients think this data is being shared already, and it's surprising to them when they find that it's not, when they're being treated, that their doctors don't have all their health records. But nevertheless, when you talk about these sort of game-changing technologies that are coming onto the scene that are replacing or meant to replace the one-to-one transactions that largely occur today, whether they're done in paper or electronic format, we have said that again, because they're new, patients should have the right, at a minimum, to be able to opt out of having their data shared through this network, even for treatment purposes. And my understanding in some of the locations across the country that I've looked at is that the rate of either opt out or non-opt in, depending on where you set the decision point, is very low. And that says a very positive thing. But then again, it raises questions. Well, how granular is that choice? Are you in for everything if you opt in, or are you in by provider, which is something that they've done in Massachusetts? And so without making this answer get too lengthy, it is a decision that networks across the country are grappling with on an individualized basis as of today. But I think there's a desire on the part of this administration to think about whether or not there needs to be federal policy in this regard, particularly with respect to who's eligible for the federal dollars and what types of policies are they going to need to have in place. And so, you know, those discussions, I think, are going to be more in the forefront really soon. But they're not easy ones, because my general question is, well, consent to what? Like, what are you asking people to opt into? Are they going to get a full and complete information of who has access to the data in the exchange and under what circumstances? Is data being sold in order to support the financial obligation of running the exchange? And how does that work? And how much are people going to really be able to meaningfully understand that? Is there an educational process involved in allowing people to opt in, or are they just given a sheet of paper? And that then triggers all the concerns that we've laid out in the paper about what the limits can be of patient consent, because in many ways it depends on, you know, just it really becomes dependent on the patient to fully understand how their data is being used, rather than looking at more of a data stewardship model where the data holder has certain obligations with respect to how they treat your data and when they share it. So stay tuned, to be continued.
Can I ask a follow-up on your question just to Devin, because you mentioned that this that the rates of opting out were low, and I'm very curious, because I think part of your question is opt-out versus opt-in. Do we know if the rates are different if you give patients an option to opt out where versus if it's incumbent
if they have
to opt in? Sort of this default setting.
That's a really good question, and it's I haven't seen any study on that, but I think it would be, I just have some anecdotal examples without, good hard numbers in my head, but I know that up in Massachusetts, the health information exchanges that they set up there, that they made a decision at the beginning that they would get people to opt in, and they had a very rigorous educational program, and they used the doctors in the community to help people understand what they were doing, and they had like a 98% opt-in rate. Other areas, Tennessee allows you to do an opt-out, but very few people have taken advantage of it. But I can't compare the process between the two organizations. And we're also talking about exchanges that are just exchanging data for treatment, which is where most of these exchanges are at this sort of early nascent stage. So I think we're trying to anticipate what the concerns might be in the long run while setting policy to make it work in the short term.
Go ahead.
Iris Courtney. I'm not representing an organization today, although at different times I have represented some related to this issue. I'm both a science and tech writer as well as a patient advocate. And I want to apologize for not having read the full paper when I asked these questions. On the other hand, I'm thinking you're probably going to be glad I didn't, because I actually have a background in statistics, and so this will keep me out of the weeds in terms of that. But I'm looking forward to reading it thoroughly. I really want to raise several issues on this. I guess as an editor and also a data person, I always look at the wording and the way the thesis or hypothesis is phrased as a way to define or suggest to us where we're going to end up. And I have to say from the outset, when I'm looking at the question being posed of, I guess your article is called Privacy Protection and Technology Diffusion, the Case of EM Records, clearly what you're looking at is, the focus is how to get EMR more widely adapted. Same thing in terms of today's program, in terms of the trade-off, the cost of privacy. Now, I have to say to you, as both patient advocate and in that role a couple of years ago, working with some breast cancer organizations, I took part in a full-day HHS focus group symposium on HIT with a cross-section of patient groups represented, not just looking at privacy, but looking at a whole range of issues of the benefits and disadvantages on it. I have to tell you, from listening to the perspectives on that, won't be surprised to hear that there was not a single, that people were interested in the benefits, but there was not a single organization represented that was not very concerned about privacy because of several issues. And the ACM person here, I'm sure, I love that you're there on that. Because part of these are technical issues that are not trivial on this. You can't work on the safety safeguards, the confidentiality safeguards, as something that will take care of eventually, but the importance is to move ahead and people will be doing that. Think, for example, the problems that have occurred in terms of credit data bureau access, where incorrect information is inputted in there, and how hard it is to correct it and to identify it and track it back once it's in there. Take the information that just gets dumped from a number of different sources, and it's the patient or the individual who is responsible for making sure that the info about me is accurate. Think, for example, the issue, I would just say, the question I would hope that you would broader umbrella within which your study should fit should be the economic benefits and risks of HIT implementation with varying degrees of privacy safeguards. And the economic benefits are not just related to the economic benefits of health care delivery. Clearly, that is the first issue in terms of what you were talking about, the infant mortality rates. But secondly, you also need to know about the impact, for example, on the patient willingness to participate in clinical trials without related to genetic or family history health issues, without being able to ensure anonymity. Now, in fact, you know, I've worked on these things and written about these things over the last number of years. I can tell you, Georgetown did some really good studies on genetic testing related to breast cancer, and at one of the first things that they told participants was all the efforts that they would take to ensure that complete confidentiality, that nobody could access this via the web. Now, there, in fact, are economic impacts on medical research that would be affected by people being less willing to take part in clinical trials. So health outcomes, obviously, but in terms of needing people to participate on economic research. You additionally need to get employment bias for unauthorized access, and that's where ACM comes in in terms of making sure that health IT is not implemented before it can be assured that the confidentiality is preserved on that. And so I love your study as a start, but it scares me to death that would be the only slice of the study, because the economics of it are broader than just the immediate cost savings from the medical perspective of it.
Let me give you a chance to respond to that.
Sure. So first of all, I do hope that you read the study in its entirety, because I think you will find that many of these issues you're bringing up are issues that we do talk about in terms of the concerns that patients have and some of the related to healthcare IT and privacy in particular. And the second thing I'd like to say, of course, is that I agree with the idea that this is just one part of the picture, and this is one study, hopefully of many that we will be writing, looking at health outcomes. We have other research looking at other costs and benefits associated with healthcare IT. In terms of the one point that I just think would be helpful for me to clarify is that the view of the study is really not about advocating a particular position. The study is really an empirical analysis of what's going on. We're not coming out starting from a place of saying healthcare IT is good and we're out to prove that, or to say privacy protection is good or bad. The study is an empirical question saying, what is the effect of this policy on this outcome? Now, in terms of how we interpret that study, you know, that could have to do with that. That's something that then is beyond the scope of the study. The study, I hope you'll find, is not at all coming out from a perspective, I think, that takes either side. And in fact, as authors, I know when we started it, we had no idea which way it would go. I mean, we thought it's possible, you know, those two competing stories, either one of them sounded at least superficially plausible, and that's why it was inherently an empirical question. And so we really were very careful about modeling and robustness and ensuring that we let the data tell us what's happening in the world. Now, the question about interpretation and where to go from that, I think, is, of course, an area for lively debate. We hope to at least to contribute to that with some empirical evidence, some facts on the ground, so to speak, that can inform that debate.
Deborah, did you have anything you wanted to add?
No, I think I covered some of your points in the critique, but it was, you know, people feel very passionately about these issues, and you cannot underestimate that at all. It's important, and that's why I started my comments by saying we're not talking about privacy versus non-privacy. I mean, I hope not. I think that should be squarely off the table in my view.
I just wanted to add, you may be interested in an event we had recently in Silico, the benefits of IT to medical research, because we had a number of medical researchers come up and talk about how privacy is important, because not only do you want patients to participate in these studies, but you want to make sure that the data can actually be shared with the researchers. And that can be a problem if you have privacy regulations that are too strict. So when we talk about having new technology like rapid learning health networks, we talk about what the National Cancer Institute is doing, we talk about what other organizations can do, like Merck with drug research or other kind of pandemic modeling. It is important that information can flow to the right sources. Go ahead.
Hasn't the horse left the barn a little bit here? the president has stated already that by 2012 or 2014, he wants to see every American have an electronic medical record. And certainly under the stimulus bill and probably in how the incentives play out in health reform, it will be kind of geared towards use of data to drive cost savings, to reap the benefits. And so even though the empirical data might not exist yet, I think the decision makers have kind of concluded that there are cost savings to be had, there are public health benefits and other benefits to be had about kind of the data sharing. So aren't we almost backfilling a little bit to figure out kind of what sort of privacy regime we need to put in place to make sure consumers are comfortable with the way this gets adopted? But it seems at this point we're almost going about this a little bit backwards in terms of where the policy is, and I just wanted to feel that some comment on that.
Well, my instinct might be, so we have this aim as a country about what we want to achieve, and what I would take from our study is that we're saying privacy protection seems to be perhaps an impediment, or at least something we need to get right if we achieve to achieve this aim. And if we're going to spend so much money on achieving this aim, we want to make sure that we're not, by perhaps loose wording in terms of how we talk about privacy protection, or perhaps a lack of care and thought, making our lives more difficult and perhaps costing us a lot more money to get to this place that we want to be.
Right, and also the previous president also had healthcare IT and a National Health Information Network. Was it by 2014?
Yes.
I think President Bush had that plan as well. So,
waiting for the penalties for when I don't have my electronic medical record and I have to pay more taxes.
This is a bipartisan, long-standing.
Well, if I can just, but at the same time, you know, if there is, as Senator Wyden puts it in the financial context, the Exxon Valdez of privacy, and we've already seen some data leakage. All you need is one big bad thing to happen, where the public, you know, massive backlash, and then you've got Leahy, Snow, Congressman Markey. You know, we can see a bill happen quickly if the opposite happens. So.
No, I think you're right. I mean, we are actually at a pretty critical point in the implementation. So there's not just the desire to have us all with electronic medical records by 2014, but now actually there's the financial backing and the infrastructure in place that's more likely to make that happen, which we didn't have in the Bush administration, in my view. But we're still, I think, at a pretty critical point. I think we cannot say for certain that all of this will work, because there's a lot of decisions that need to be made about sort of what are the triggers for getting the money. If people, in fact, buy a certified system, will it exchange data in the way that we think and hope that it will? Is this all going to work? You know, we've spent a lot of years at this, and we're not that much further forward than we were when this all started. So, but I don't mean to sound overly pessimistic. I think the building blocks are in place to make this happen. And now is the time to be thinking about, you know, if there are remaining obstacles in the road, whether it's lack of trust or some laws that were put in place in a paper-based regime that don't work very well and actually inhibit information sharing for treatment purposes, then now is actually the time to deal with it. And I've had people ask me, I heard about state laws that, you know, you can't get lab data sent to anybody but the ordering physician, which is going to create obstacles to patients getting a hold of their data. And absolutely. But, you know, the states have to come to the table and fix some of this stuff, too. And so there's really got to be a fair amount of attention paid. We could squander this opportunity if we don't take it seriously. So while I agree with you, Frank, that we're, you know, the horse is running down the track, right? But it doesn't mean that we couldn't, without attention to some of this stuff, end up far short of the goal that we've set, which would be really unfortunate.
Are there any other questions? Well, great. Well, I'd like to thank everyone for coming out and join me in thanking our panelists.